kind of a little contemplative ritual that I go through in the morning. I read some different authors, and then I do 20 minutes of just meditation. It just really clears the deck for me and puts me in a place that divorces me from all kinds of left brain activity.
That's John McCutcheon. I'm Jamie Green, and this is Trading Fours. Hey everybody, welcome back. It is the last show of 2021, people. It's been an amazing year, so many great guests. And I'm super excited to let you know that we're going to end on a high note with another amazing guest. Today's guest is John McCutcheon, who is right up in the capstone of folk music singer-songwriters, and he plays a bazillion instruments, and he has been really busy doing a lot of great things since the early 1970s. And I think you might be saying, Jamie, you're a rock and roll guy. And you're right, I am a rock and roll guy. But you know, the best part of this podcast is I get to explore other things and open my mind and listen to other things. And good music is good music. And I love melodies. So the one way you're going to lose me is if your song doesn't have a beautiful melody or a good melody. And that is certainly not the case with Mr. McCutcheon. He is so talented. He has received 6 Grammy Award nominations over the years. He is known as like the master of the hammered dulcimer. And if you don't know what one of those is, I will put a video down in the show notes. But he's also a really intellectual guy, really cool guy, and we had a great chat. And we chatted about a lot of things, including one of the best-kept secrets in Kansas City is the World War I Museum, which is, I would say, one of the best museums in the country. It's great. And John has written a song about World War I, and we're going to talk about that. And it's very apropos because it was a Christmas song as well. So we're going to get started. Here's my conversation with John McCutcheon. So if you're ready, I'm ready.
I'm set to go.
Well, it's so nice of you to join me on my podcast, Trading Fours. And, you know, John, I really enjoyed the new album.
Oh, thanks.
And I think it's really interesting because one of the songs that really kind of stuck on my mind was the song Be Still. Because we were all forced to be still for a very long time. And for musicians especially who their life has been on the road and constant movement, it's almost a meditative thing, isn't it? That you have to kind of be okay with yourself. So I would love to hear your process of writing this and kind of where you were coming from.
Well, all the songs on the album were written in kind of the same manner. Backing up a little bit, I was in Australia until mid-March of last year. So I came home to a very different world than I had left. And because I'd been overseas and on a plane for 24 hours, I thought the only responsible thing to do would be to quarantine myself. So I went to the aforementioned little log cabin up in the woods of North Georgia, me and my dog, for 3 weeks, just to make sure I wouldn't give anything to my wife or my mother-in-law who lives with us. And it's a place that my wife, who was also a writer, and I got for the purposes of having a nice quiet place to write. And I began to write there. And the process was that I have kind of a little contemplative ritual that I go through in the morning. I read some different authors and then I do 20 minutes of just meditation. And it just really clears the deck for me and puts me in a place that divorces me from all kinds of left brain activity.
Yeah.
And, you know, even in March, the weather is pretty nice up in North Georgia. So I would sit on our porch and probably most of the songs on Bucket List and Cabin Fever, which was the album that preceded it, were written in that rocking chair on that porch by sitting down and saying and having no intention of what I was going to write. I didn't even intend that it was going to be a song or that it would be a completed song, but after doing it for 50 years, you kind of know how to bring it home. With the song Be Still, one of the people that I have read really regularly is Thomas Merton, who is a Catholic monk and probably one of the most influential theological writers. And he was one of the people who, beginning in the late 50s, early 60s, he died in 68, started looking at meditation as a form of prayer, which Catholics have always been kind of rote mm-hmm. prayer people, and always directed by clergy. Merton sort of turned that whole notion on its head, and also looked at Buddhism and lots of more contemplative Eastern style religion. He was the first Catholic to really do that. I was raised Catholic. My mother had his autobiography on her bookshelf, one of the few books that was in our house. And it took me till I was in my 50s to read it. And one of the things during the pandemic that a lot of us have done is reached out to friends who we could have really lengthy conversations with. And one of those people one of my oldest friends who I grew up with, who has been into meditation since the rocks were soft. And then another artist who's on my agent's roster, a woman by the name of Carrie Newcomer. And between my friend Rich from childhood and Carrie, who is another musician, we just started talking a lot about how we're using this time. And the time also threw us back into a time that we often don't have enough time for, which is writing. And I find that writing is a really meditative act for me. And I have to really, to give a shout out to my song, Be Still, in order to let me enter into that place where the song is written. Because as you can tell from the stuff on the album, mm-hmm. it goes all over the place. Everything from, imagining a white supremacist revisiting the scene of the crime to, the noises my grandfather used to make is just sitting down in his chair. And none of those were intentional. I would just, in the case of Atonement, I didn't know what I was going to write. And a truck went by our cabin and I heard gravel crackle in the tires. And I just wrote that down and boom, that song just kind of poured out. But in a broader sense too, any of your listeners who know my work know that I've also been pretty politically active. And I think one of the things that is often forgotten is to revisit those big ideas mm-hmm. that are bigger than any contemporary movement or action or issue, and try to really focus on what the point of your activism is. So that's a really long answer.
No, that's great. Well, I just, I meditate as well. Mm-hmm. 20 minutes, supposed to do it twice a day, John. I get the morning and the afternoon. I'm like all of us, I'm a work in progress, right?
Right.
But I was searching for this line because I was saying it's so true, where you said nothing is more daring than the willingness to learn.
Yeah.
And be still. And I think all of this entire time, it's been really interesting. So you'll be over 90 episodes that I've done. And this has been a big Rorschach test, I think, not only for just musicians, but the world. And I've had musicians who say, I really just doubled down and I got super creative and I stuck my head down. I had musicians who said, I'm really depressed. This has been really hard. I mean, it runs the gamut. But I think it costs all of us to kind of re-examine things and what are the priorities, like you were saying about your political activism and your political beliefs. And you reassess a lot of things when you have this much time to sit at home. Right.
Well, yeah. And I think that one of the interesting things is going to be what lessons we take forward. And I think you're seeing it in, the lack of labor out there right now. A lot of people are, every musician I know who I'm talking to is saying, I don't know how I'm going to gear up to get out there again. I want to get out there again, but I actually like being home. And I think a lot of us discovered that we actually do have time for reading. We just didn't utilize it before. And when you're not getting on an airplane every weekend, which has been my life for 50 years, it was amazing what you could actually accomplish. I mean, I took, you know, throat singing classes online and started to really dive into my Cajun accordion and got to spend time with my family. You know, I haven't slept in my own bed this much since high school.
Right.
And my wife and I still like one another. It was never a given. We've not been together this much ever.
Yeah. I think it either got couples either got closer together, mm-hmm. or if it was a relationship that wasn't on real solid footing, that was the, this was the fissure that kind of blew, because I've known so many people who've gotten divorced now. Yeah. But yeah, my wife and I joke with each other that we really like each other still, which is great.
If we can make it through this.
Right.
Well, and also that a lot of people I talk to, especially musicians, said, yeah, I'm making a little bit doing online concerts and stuff like that, or maybe teaching online, but I'm not spending hardly anything. So what does this tell us about what we take from this going forward? If this was just time out and we go right back to it, I think we're missing an opportunity. And so I had to stop writing.
Okay.
When I got to like 100 songs, and Tom Paxson and I write together every Monday. There's a woman from England I'm writing to. Carrie Newcomb and I are just about to launch into something. But as far as my own stuff, the kind of stuff that ended up on Bucket List, I had to stop at some point and say, okay, what do I do with this now? I need to, I won't have time to organize this and get this music out there if I'm writing all the time. So I'm actually finishing up this month a third album written during the pandemic, because it's such a good time to put out CDs, right?
Yeah.
People are just clamoring for more CDs. But I'm just about to get back into that, and I'm really excited about it.
No, I think that's great. You know, it's there's all these talk about, like, you know, Shakespeare wrote some of his greatest plays during when they were having, you know, the bubonic plague, because he was locked in his house, right? Like, if you don't take advantage of this time to be creative, if you can't be creative now and work on your craft and try to hone it, I mean, I can't think of a better time. Like, right, you know. Time is such a luxury that most musicians, touring musicians like yourself, don't have a whole lot of usually. So I'm glad to see that you are making the most of it.
Well, I think there have been times in the past few decades where artists found themselves either immobilized. Think of 9/11. Mm-hmm. A lot of musicians and artists I knew just said, I don't know. I don't know what to say. I don't know how to say it. And other people, myself, for instance, just couldn't shut up, you know. And the same thing happened during the pandemic. And it's a way in which I've processed the world from the time I was a teenager. So I have seen certain important mileposts in my life. And I've said, well, I want to explore really what's going on. When I met my first granddaughter, for instance, I said, this is going to be really important, and I really want to take a deep dive into this, and just said, okay, I'm going to write every day now just to see what comes up. And same thing was true, of course, with this. And it helped that I had no distractions.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
And I have come out the other side, if this is in fact the other side.
I'm crossing fingers.
This
will be audio, but that's what I'm doing.
Yeah. Now that a lot of musicians are out there, you know, dipping their toes into the touring world again, you know, my attitude is, I'm almost 70 years old. I've been working under this model that started when I was 20. And maybe that model is not what I have to do. You know, maybe I don't have to go out 2 to 3 weekends a month. Maybe really what I should be doing is a lot more writing. And that's been my big takeaway from this time. So I'm only going out one weekend a month, spending a lot more time touring. And you know, the whole online concert thing, I think is here to stay in some way, shape or form. And yeah, I'll do one of those a month. And that's what I want to do. I want to write more. It's real. I love it. It's the second greatest feeling in the world. And, you know, it's what's going to be here after I'm gone.
No, and I think I really enjoy your album. I think, you know, there's something to be said for the beauty of a fiddle coming in on a song, right? There's just some of those magical moments. And I love the Bucket List song too, because what we were talking about, our wives and stuff that you, I mean, and you wrote the song. So if I get it wrong, I apologize. But basically the gist of it is that you've seen all these amazing things and wonderful things around the world, and you list a bunch of them. But in the end, the connection and love you have with your wife is, it's greater than all of them, correct?
Well, that's the great adventure.
Right. You
know? And right. And everything in the song is not something I have done. A lot of the things I have done. But I thought, gosh, I've never really had a bucket list. I should pretend I have one. And what are the things that would be really cool to do that I haven't done? But the point really was, the great adventure is right here. And that's been another gift from, and the fiddle, I mean, if you're going to have a fiddle player, it might as well be Stuart Duncan.
Yeah.
Who, you know, the piano player, John Carroll on the project, you know, many years ago, because Stuart's been on my albums forever, said, oh, you're going to get a fiddle player. Who are you going to get? And I said, Stuart Duncan. And he said, oh, he said, wow. And I said, yeah, you can do worse than Stuart. And he paused and said, everybody's worse than Stuart. Well, he is so lyrical,
mm-hmm.
and he listens and he invests. I mean, that's one of the reasons I love recording, is I have found this group of people who listen to the lyrics. They get what the songs are about. They're not just playing charts. And in fact, I don't give them charts. I say, I've done this foundational work. Let's create this end thing together. So it's, you know, everybody has their fingerprints on these. It's more fun and it's more surprising for me. And especially on Be Still, I just think everybody just, you know, fell into place there. And Stuart said, you know, I'm taking this over, excuse me.
And it's great. It was really great. You know, you're talking about, that's what I just got done this last summer, read a biography of Thelonious Monk. And that's what Monk did with, he wouldn't give the guys in the band the charts, that he wanted them to be present in the moment and reacting to what he was doing.
Right. Right.
And, you know, well, he was a genius. So there's that too.
That doesn't hurt. No. Well, I have a buddy who plays in Bruce Hornsby's band. And he said that since Hornsby came back from playing with the Dead, they won't even have set lists.
Really?
He'll just start something and it'll take a measure or two for the rest of the guys to, you know, figure out what key it's in. Oh, it's that song, or, you know, and I've played with him since, and I'll say, okay, Bobby, his name is Bobby Reed. He's a fantastic saxophone, especially soprano sax player. And he joined me in a show and I said, okay, this one's in B flat and it goes like this. And he says, no, let's just play it. I'll find it. And it's magic. It's, you know,
that's great.
That's when it, you find musicians who have really dug down deep into what music is, that kind of spontaneous, just open up your, not just your heart, your soul. And it's wonderful and exciting to be around people like that.
Absolutely. That's really cool. You probably can't see, but behind me, that's one of my grandfathers. That's his flag. And both of my grandfathers fought in the First World War. Mm-hmm. He was actually in the trenches. And I actually knew these guys when I was a little kid. They died. One died when I was 6 and one died when I was 7.
You're lucky.
So it's not really that long ago in a way. You know, I'm 53. And I know this is actually going to come out right around Christmas time. Mm-hmm. So I'm really interested. Let's talk about Christmas in the Trenches. I, you know, this is a very famous, there's a movie about it. Mm-hmm. It was at the first Christmas in the war. Was it 1914 or 19? Okay.
1914. It happened in 1915 again, not to the extent that it happened in 1914. It, for your listeners who aren't familiar with it, in everybody thought the World War I was going to be over by Christmas. And lo and behold, it wasn't going to be over for many more Christmases. And the trench warfare was horrible. More people died of disease than of bullets and bombs. And these trenches, you know, simply held place for years with virtually no advancement. And they stretched for nearly 500 miles. I was in the process back in 1984 of doing an album for Rounda Records. I was supposed to do a Hammer Dulcimer Christmas album. And I'm sure what they thought they were going to get was Hark the Herald Angels Sing and the Hallelujah Chorus and whatever. But I was not at all interested in doing anything like that. So I assembled a really unusual collection of things there. And I was about to go into the studio when I was playing in Birmingham, Alabama. And I just felt like there was something missing that was going to tie the whole album together. And I was in a backstage dressing room waiting for the show to start. And this old black woman who was a janitor, you know, came into the room not knowing anybody was going to be in there. And she was very apologetic. And we just started talking. And I said, well, you know, I'll tell you what, I'm not going to make a mess. Just go. I'll go and you can clean up the room. You can be done. Go home. Because I'm not going to be done with this room for several hours. And it seems silly for you to wait around. And we talked back and forth. She said, well, you don't even have to leave. And, you know, I'll just clean up and I'll be done. And before she left, we just started chatting and telling stories back and forth. And when someone stuck their head in and says, 2 minutes till showtime, I said, okay, got time for one more quick one. Tell me the best one you know. And it had all been jokes, punchlines and stuff like that. And she told me the story of the 1914 Christmas truce. And I had heard the story before, so it was not new to me. But it was like God sent this person to the room to remind me of that story. And I went, ah, I'm going to write a song about that. And did during the intermission of the concert that night.
That quickly.
Yeah. I mean, there are some songs that you write and others that you seem to simply write down. Every writer that you talk to has an incident like that. It could be an article, a poem, a Mother's Day card, whatever. Something comes out and you look at it and you go, wow, I'm not that good. I don't know where that came from, but thank you. And in fact, my papers are going to the Center for Southern Folklore at the University of North Carolina, and the pandemic has given me time to organize them. And I recently found the original lyrics.
Very cool.
And there's very, very little editing. So it was something that, you know, was out there in the ether, ready to come out. I've always told my songwriting students, God went around for years whispering into people's ears, dun, 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 until right. He found the deaf man that heard him.
You know? Right.
So since then, I had no idea it was going to do what it did, but I've had people come up to me who, like you, whose parents were involved in trench warfare, some whose ancestors were apparently involved in the incident because it involved hundreds of thousands of men.
Right.
I think there's this folklore that there's 20 or 30 guys playing soccer out there, but the trenches were continuous for nearly 500 miles. So you couldn't just see that there's some guys, you know, interacting with the enemy over there and we're just going to sit here. I met some men in Germany, in Denmark. They were from Germany who claimed that they had been involved. They're the only people I personally met.
Yeah, and there's so much with that. I mean, Well, there's, I mean, we could talk about this for a long time, but you know, wars are always decided by old men, but they're essentially fought, especially back then, by really boys, right?
Oh, today as well,
right?
No different.
Now it's just boys and girls now. And this idea of this horrific, I mean, if you don't know anything about the First World War, as you said, the trenches were just beyond disgusting and horrific and horrible. My grandfather actually talked about rats that were the size of cats, and I thought he was kidding. And then I got older and read books, and nope, that was true, because they were eating corpses and on and on. And I think it's such an interesting dichotomy, because you have this horror war and death, and then there's this very short time of like a halftime of a football game where they put down all that and the joy of life and what connects us all, which is music, right? And sports. And mm-hmm. there's a little respite from it, but it's not enough to overcome all the awfulness, and it goes back to where it is. So,
well, it didn't entirely go back to where it was. There were some places where the fraternization was enough that people shot over one another's heads, and they had to move people around. But you're in Kansas City, which is where the World War One Museum, of course. Right. is, and on the 100th anniversary weekend of the Christmas truce, I actually performed at the World War One Museum, a centenary concert. But yeah, World War One, it was a war that didn't have to happen. I mean, historians are pretty much in agreement with that right now. And if there hadn't been a World War One, there wouldn't have been a World War Two. Because all the pieces were set in place, the subjugation of Germany and the nationalism that came out of that in the 1930s that led to power by Hitler and da-da-da-da. But the story is beyond the historical elements of it, speak to the anonymity that is necessary for people who have no quarrel personally to go out and kill one another. And once you break that down, even if it's just for, as you say, the halftime of a football game, it changes people. It changes their perspective of, well, what am I doing? Whose family have I got my sights on right now? And that's how change happens, when there is human contact, when it's one of the gifts of music. You can change happens when not only when you change people's minds, but when you change their hearts. And music does that in a really unique way. You invite someone into a story. My name is Francis Tolliver, and I'm not telling you what you should think about this. Let me just tell you my story. I'm done with my story now, and you're left with how it's affected you, what you think about it, how you feel about it. And, you know, so hopefully every little grain of sand on the balance will add to our evolution as a species.
Yeah, you hope. So the books, were you writing already, John? And then someone said, hey, let's do a book on it with the illustrator. Was it something new that you were trying? How did that come about?
I had written a book. Well, I'd written a song years before called Happy Adoption Day. And Little Brown, the publisher, contacted me one day just out of the blue. All my friends who are authors who have their agents knocking on publishers' doors hate me when I tell them this story. Little Brown, this major publisher, just came to me and said, hey, we love this song and we want to do a picture book of it. But it's not long enough, so could you write a couple more verses? And I said, sure. And that just came out. My wife writes, her name is Carmen Agraditi, and she's a quite highly regarded and loved children's picture book author. And she's the one who first came to me and said, this is a story that children need to know about, because they're not going to hear about it in their history books. And they're not going to hear your song probably, and they're not, you know, it's not going to be a television special. And when they're children is when you want them to know these important stories, so they can say, as they get older, hey, that's dumb. Right. You know, why do we do it this way? If war solved our problems, golly, we've had enough. We shouldn't have any more problems. And I had thought that for a long time, but this was the first time someone sat me down and said, here's how you make this song into a picture book for children. Because with Happy Adoption Day, they simply took the lyrics of the song. I literally had to do almost no work. I got in touch with the illustrator via the publisher, because my wife Carmen had written a book called The Yellow Star. It's the story of King Christian X of Denmark, who, you know, the Reader's Digest story is when the Nazis took over Denmark, they said all the Jews had to wear a yellow star. So the king the next day went out, a non-Jew, wearing a yellow star. And the populace got the notion, and pretty much everybody, it was an I Am Spartacus moment. And it affected the survival rate of Danish Jews. Fewer than 500 Danish Jews died in concentration camps. And they were protected by their fellow citizens. But the illustrator that she used for that book, Henry Sorensen, is a Dane, and the publisher thought this would be a perfect combination, that sort of classical oil painting kind of look for this story. The other book I have out is the story of the cellist of Sarajevo, who's a friend of mine. I met him because I wrote the song. He heard about the song and we became friends. And I wanted to tell that story, which is, you know, kind of related to Christmas in the Trenches, in that in Christmas in the Trenches, you have the horrors of war, and in the midst of this, Christmas happens. And in the case of the subject of the book, Flowers of Sarajevo, you had a bombing, a mortar attack on the last operating bakery in Sarajevo, and 22 people standing in a bread line were killed. And the following day, precisely at the hour of the attack the day before, this cellist from the Sarajevo Opera Orchestra, which rehearsed across the square from the bakery, showed up in a tuxedo, sat down in front of the bakery, and played Abbononi's Adagio in G minor. And played that single piece and then left. And everybody went, what? Then he showed up the next day, played the same piece of music at the same time, and left. So for 22 days, he played. And I didn't really want to write it about that. I wanted to write it from the perspective of a kid, which is the way you open a story like that up. You know, in Christmas in the Trenches, it was a grandfather telling his grandchildren, this is what happened to me. Here was a kid who observed this and was changed by it, and did, he was a flower seller in the square, changed how he approached his work there and the other people. So I had my wife really was the person who taught me how to do this. And it's really different. It's hard. It's great fun. And it's great to know that kids grow up knowing these stories, which is the point.
Yeah, because I think with Sarajevo, you and I are both old enough to remember when it was a bustling city beforehand, and the Olympics were there, and it was, right? I mean, this is an ancient history. This is the early 1990s when all this happened.
Yeah, this particular thing happened in May of 1992.
Right. I mean, that's not that long ago, really not that long ago. And certainly, you know, we're talking about human nature and things like that. It's really hard to kill somebody that you know, or, I mean, if you think of human beings as that we're all human beings, we generally have the same things. You know, we love our kids. We want to be safe and have our friends around, stuff like that. It's harder. It's when we make these divisions, right, where it's Muslims versus Catholics and all those things. That's when it gets a little easier, and where somebody could do something that horrific and shoot a shell. And like you said, a bunch of people who are just trying to get fed.
Right. They were just, well, and in, It is kind of a very different angle from Christmas in the Trenches, because, and I think it's apropos to today, that people who, you know, I mean, think of the troubles in Ireland. You had people killing people and then going to their respective churches and praying to the same God. So, and today you have Democrats and Republicans. And it's not like they're mortaring one another, but it certainly feels like warfare.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas most of the people are innocent victims on the outside, and, you know, the warring parties are, you know, unleashing this horror in front of you.
Well, I'm, as you said, I'm here in Kansas City, and you played the World War I Museum. I do think anybody who has not been there and had a chance to see it, it's a wonderful museum. They do a great job with it. I think the Poppies feel that you have to physically walk over to go to the museum. Oh, is a very powerful statement, right?
It is. And they actually do have trenches there.
Yes.
That you can go and feel like you're walking through. I mean, you know, it'd be great if you could get wet and develop trench foot and all that kind of stuff. But you do get the sense of the claustrophobic nature of all that. And you imagine for literally years, this was your home.
Yeah. Yeah. For everybody, you know, America, we came in really late. The rest of the world was in, you know, it was 4 years for everybody else.
Right.
Are you going to come to the Folk Festival this year?
To Folk Alliance, you mean?
Yes.
I'm not sure. Again, it's one of those, oh, golly, you know, be away from home for 4 days. I used to go every single year. I was the president of Local 1000 of the Musicians Union, which is the local that deals with traveling musicians. And being as we don't have a union hall like every other local, because our membership is scattered all over North America, that was the place where most of our membership, or a lot of our membership, seemed to gather. And so I would go every year. And since I've retired from that position, I haven't. But I love what Folk Alliance is doing. I'm a great supporter of theirs. So I may. It's one of those things that right now it's not on the docket, but I mean, I was part of their virtual conference last year.
Yeah, and it's so, for people who, most of my listeners are Kansas Cityans. I do have people from other parts, but I would say 80% from what I see. It's such a great event. It's not here every year. The Folk Alliance headquarters themselves are here, mm-hmm. But it's here many years. I mean, I would say almost 80% of the time it's here, and there's amazing musicians. It's very collaborative. I love the idea where they go up and so they have the showcases in the hotel rooms at night. Mm-hmm. It's really cool.
Well, and I think the kind of ecumenical nature that Folk Alliance has adopted is really on full display there. I go to a festival now, and I've been going to festivals for 50 years, and I don't know 2/3 of the people on the bill. And at first that was kind of distressing, because it used to be, oh, these are, you know, all my pals are here. This was our chance to get together and reunite, because unlike other adults, we don't have things like that. And you don't want to be in the same town on the same night usually. And so it's very exciting now. There's a really vibrant scene of young musicians and musicians that, you know, how to diversify. Folk festivals, for instance, has been on the docket for years and years and years. And nobody has really done that much with it. Folk Alliance came along and kind of coalesced the thinking. And now it's really exciting. Yes. And this is one of the places to go. And I get to make all kinds of new friends.
That's just great. That's the greatest part of music, is the friendships and the collaborations you develop. Correct.
And that's that. Yes. And that's one of the things that's unusual about, I think, the folk music community. I've certainly found that. I mean, I discovered folk music because my mom made me sit down and watch the March on Washington on TV. I didn't know folk music existed, but here was Joan Baez and Bob Dylan, Peter Paul, Marion Odetta, and Len Chandler. I mean, in addition to Mahalia Jackson and Marian Anderson and preaching like I never heard in church on Sunday. And it was a righteous movement. I knew that at 11. But it was connected to something that was bigger than mere entertainment. And as I got involved in it, I was welcomed into it because it was all about participation rather than about performance. It was like, get your guitar, get a banjo, and just sing along. And as I, you know, became a professional, I found it very fraternal. I found it very collaborative and collective, which is one thing that made organizing something like Local 1000 not only easier, but logical in a way. We were less competitors than we were comrades. And Folk Alliance has that on full display, which is, we don't have enough of that.
Amen to that. I think music's one of the few things we can actually agree on, right? For the most part.
Well,
not always, but I'm just saying, like, you know, I mean, you don't know in your crowd who's there. Like, you don't know who's a registered Republican or a, you know, you don't know. No, it's people like your music.
The thing that's interesting to me now, having a few years under my belt, is, you know, political music kind of, I look at it as having kind of two tracks, and it's not different from religious music. In religious music, you have praise and proselytizing. And if you think about it, in political music, you have praise, you know, what they call semi-disparagingly preaching to the choir, which is important. I mean, it's what a USO show is, isn't it?
Totally.
And the other is how you go about introducing new ideas and bringing more people into your way of thinking or into your community. And that's really interesting to me. So you're right. I have no idea who's out there. Some people come just because they like the hammered dulcimer. Some people come because, golly, here's a singer-songwriter who plays the banjo, for God's sake. Or they raise their kids on my music, and I don't expect them to subscribe to a predetermined set of values. In fact, I don't think anybody should subscribe to a predetermined set of values. It's the sign of a weak mind. You got to challenge yourself. You say, do I believe this, or I'm simply buying a party line? So, you know, what's really interesting is how you can create an event in a concert, for instance, that takes people on a little ride. And hopefully they've been introduced some things they didn't know about. Maybe they laughed, they got pissed off, maybe they cried, but at the end of it, it's like, you know, I'm a different person now. I remember going to see a piano concert when I was like 8. My mom took me because I was begging her to let me take piano lessons. And I walked out and I thought, I'm a different person now. I've never heard this much music in one place. I got dressed up. It was like going to church. Everybody was quiet and clapped, and I had to learn how to behave, and wow, that was amazing. I want to do that again. So yeah, but you know, if you had Tom Morello and Toby Keith on the same bill, you'd find out pretty clearly. You know,
can I tell you something really funny before we go? I mean, I could talk to you for hours, but I want to be respectful of your time. I saw somebody had actually put on, tweeted at Tom Morello, Tom, why are you being so political? You shouldn't be political, Tom.
Oh, God.
If you're political, people or your fans are going to be turned off. And I was like, oh, my God, could you be any more clueless about Tom Morello's life and his thing? It just made me laugh. I literally laughed out loud when I saw this post because I was like,
well, you know, it happens to a lot of people. I've watched it happen to Jason Isbell. I mean, good heavens, look what happened to the Dixie Chicks.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Pete Seeger was dragged before Congress.
Yeah.
He was convicted. And I've always thought that politics, like music, is too important to be left to the experts. And citizenship comes with some responsibilities. And, you know, my basic attitude is, you know, why should, if on one hand is to be humble enough to say, why should anybody care what I think? And informed by that, saying, how can I tell a story that conveys an idea and challenges a way of thinking, or maybe challenges you to think at all, in a way that's digestible. Otherwise, I'm just sitting up here politically masturbating. And what good is that? It's you know, I don't believe in virtue signaling, to use a new term. I want people, you know, I'm old enough. I just want to get stuff done.
Yeah.
And if it means consorting with somebody I disagree with, if it'll get something done, great. Let's do it, because we have to work together.
Yeah. And then, you know, God, it's so, people don't know that about Pete Seeger. People don't realize that, like, how many lives were destroyed for having an opinion that was different than the people who were in power. And he's just one of, I mean, how many other people were blacklisted? Their lives were ruined for ideas.
Well, Pete was blacklisted,
right?
You know, he was the linchpin of the most popular group in America at the time, the Weavers. I mean, younger people have no idea. The Weavers were way more famous than any of the folk singing groups. Simon and Garfunkel, Peter, Paul and Mary, Kinks and Trio, forget it. I mean, Irene Goodnight was the number one song in America for 13 weeks in a row. That had never happened before, and it didn't happen again for decades. But to me, what was so graceful and gracious about Pete's response to the House Un-American Activities Committee is he did not take the fifth, as many people did. He did not name names. He simply said, and when you hear this, you think, oh, of course. He said, these are questions no American should be asked. We have freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, freedom of press, freedom of religion. The kind of questions you're asking, no American should be asked, because these rights are guaranteed. And you know, I think what we found, and we continue to find, because there are challenges today as well, that freedom is something you have. It's not something you're given. You have it. And when people try to take it away, the degree to which you will fight to maintain your freedom and defend your freedom tells you how free you are. Because if you let people take your freedom away, then it's like, oh, okay, well, you're not really free then. And that is a line of thinking that I can hear Second Amendment defenders pick right up and wave the flag over, but also people who are blacklisted for their political beliefs on the other end of the spectrum. It's a basic truism, and it extends to people, to Americans. So,
yeah. Well, Colin Kaepernick, I mean, that's in the last 5 to 6 years, right? Oh. I mean, the guy spoke up. They didn't like what he said, didn't like what he was doing. And, you know, that was it. He's never playing in the NFL ever again. And, you know, they need backup quarterbacks in the NFL. It's a dangerous sport where people get hurt. You know, it's not, I was, while you were talking, I was thinking, so I always had said, you know, I do my day job is public policy stuff. I do that kind of stuff. And I, you know, I've worked with Republicans, I've worked with Democrats. I try to be a thing, but when the former guy was in office, who I'm not going to name, cause I don't want to
give names, you know,
right. Exactly. It's like Voldemort.
Sorry.
Anyway, on my personal Facebook page, I tried to point out, I was like, this is not normal, people. What's going on right now? This is not normal. This is not what, you know, this is not what we're like and stuff. And my bass player said, you know, I'm hearing some grumblings from people and they don't want to hire us for gigs. And I was like, I don't care. Because if you don't speak up now, if you won't say something now, when are you going to say something? And I'm not anywhere close to Pete Seeger's guts or musical talent or anything, you know, I'm just a schmo. But if you don't have, like you said, freedom's only there if you embrace it and actually utilize it. It's not going to be there if you just lay around like a lemming and they'll take it away from you, because as we've seen throughout history, people are more than happy to take your freedom away. So,
well, and what I think what will mark us as human beings, if you think about the people who are most admired in the musical world or in the public sphere, it's not because they were great orators or songwriters or banjo players or athletes even. It's because they were courageous. And what people forget is that fear is a necessary prerequisite of courage. If you're not afraid and you go ahead and do something, well, you haven't been courageous because you don't realize the risks you're taking. But Pete knew exactly, because he had seen his friends become anonymous. I mean, talk about cancel culture. That was absolutely it. And it had consequences in people's livelihoods and their families and their standing in their community and their ability to create anything at all.
Yeah.
So God bless those people who had the guts.
Yeah.
And may they be models for us, and may we who follow in their footsteps be worthy.
Absolutely. I mean, lastly, you know, Muhammad Ali, mm-hmm. what he did. I mean, he was a great fighter, but there's been a lot of really good fighters. Like you said, like, he knew what he was going to lose doing what he did.
Right. Well, I think history will show Colin Kaepernick as a courageous figure.
Absolutely. Well, it's really nice to chat with you. Like I said, I could chat all day, and I really love the new album. It's been a lot of fun to get to chat, and when you come back to Kansas City, I would love to say hello to you when you're out playing, and
please do.
I hope you and your family have a great holiday season and continue to be safe, and that we do get back to some sense of normalcy sooner than later.
Right back at you. Thanks a lot.
All right, John, take care. Have a good day.
Yep. Bye-bye. At the solstice, Grand Canyon's rim at dawn, the opera house in Sydney with the new year coming on, Tierra del Fuego with the salt sea in my face.
John McCutcheon, everybody. That's why I don't formulate questions ahead of time. If you have a casual conversation with people and listen to their answers and just kind of, you know, react to what they say, you never know where a conversation will go. So it was so cool to get to speak so much about Pete Seeger. Pete Seeger is an American hero. As we discussed, what he did was so courageous. So not only just a great musician, but also a great patriot. So that's going to do it for this year of Trading Fours. Hey, I'm taking January off. I've got some things to do, and I want to hang out with the family over the holiday. Not only my immediate family, but some of my extended family, because we didn't get to do that last year. So I'm really looking forward to that. But I will be back on February 1st. I've got an author who's written not one, but two books about Bob Dylan. The first book was all about Bob Dylan's time in London, and the second one is about Bob Dylan. It just came out. And his experience in New York City. So look forward to that on February 1st. The author is named Keith. He actually is zooming in from London. Love the fact that it's an international podcast. So February 1st, that's when I'm back. Until then, go out, support live music, be kind to each other, be careful, be safe. And we'll talk real soon. Bye-bye. Of all life's great adventures, you're the one. So turn the bucket over, I'm done.